This morning I'd like to talk with you about the origin of man. Was it creation or evolution? Was the origin of man slime or sublime? Evolution is a theory offered as an alternative to the biblical account of creation. The Bible teaches that God created the entire universe, including man, fashioned in the image of God. Genesis 1:26 says that the Godhead said, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." Genesis 2:7, "The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." Paul said in Acts 17:24 that God made the world and all that's in it. Colossians 1:16 says that Christ created all. Hebrews 1:2 says Christ made the worlds. And we could go on. The Bible's very clear on how things got started. But the evolution story contradicts these affirmations of the Bible, alleging that science has disproved Scripture. Evolution is alleged to provide the key to the real origin of man. Now, really, in its pure sense, science cannot address the issue of origins. The problems of origins are outside the realm of science. Science deals with things that are observable, that are replicable. You can boil water in your kitchen, I can boil water in mine. And so it doesn't really deal with the matter of origins that can't be observed. When examined in the light of true scientific facts, evolution is shown to be without the supportive evidence which it claims. It's actually a totally inadequate explanation for human existence. You and I sometimes look back at the ancient peoples and we wonder how it was really possible for them to believe in Jupiter and Juno and all those other gods and goddesses. And I wonder if the world continues for a while, if future generations may well look back at the 21st century and wonder how people in it were so gullibly superstitious as to believe the theory of evolution. But many claim that the Darwinian concept has been factually established. It's not unusual at all to read in a biology textbook that all reputable biologists have agreed that evolution of life on Earth is an established fact. That is an irresponsible statement. Evolution is still a theory. It's never been proven. It's speculation. It's a guess. It's refreshing to know that even some evolutionists are honest enough to admit that there are still huge question marks connected with the theory, which even in their own minds reflect on its reliability. Charles Darwin, who popularized the theory of evolution by publishing The Origin of the Species in 1859, acknowledged that some of the problems with it were so serious that he could hardly reflect on them without being staggered himself. And this perplexity did not decrease in his declining years. And perplexity has not decreased as far as many scientists are concerned, even to this very day. Here's a statement a few years ago by a nuclear physicist. "Scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men, and the story they are telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have one iota of fact. It's a tangled mishmash of guessing games and figure juggling. If evolution occurred at all, it was probably in a very different manner from the way it is now taught," end quote. Now, there's nothing wrong with the word evolution itself. In our language, it just means an unfolding type of change. And in that sense, you are evolving as a human being. So there's nothing wrong with the word. You're evolving from a baby to a child to a young adult to middle-aged to old. You change physically. Some of us have known each other for a long enough period of time that we have seen considerable change. My hair has been four colors already. It started out blonde, and it turned to brown, and then it turned gray, and now it's white, and I don't know what will be next, but I'm hoping for red next time. I like red. Biologically, things do evolve in this sense. God has built enough variety into genetics that there are little changes within various kinds of plants and animals. In some cases with man's intervention, and in some cases without man's help. In other words, I don't believe that Noah had two Doberman Pinschers on the ark, as well as two pit bulls and two German shepherds and two chihuahuas and two poodles and two peekapoos. I don't believe that. I believe he had two dog ancestors, and from those dog ancestors, all the wolves and the coyotes and the foxes and the dingoes and the hundreds of varieties of dogs that we have now have come. That's what we call microevolution, changes within the kind. God built that into his creation with good reason. Living things need to be adaptable to climate and to life in general. All of us would agree that there have been limited changes among living creatures. Just look at the development of mankind itself, all of them coming from Adam and Eve. God has built into the genes of his living creatures on earth the ability to make lots of variety as they reproduced. The problem with the word evolution is that it got mixed up with a bunch of monkey business. And that's why I'm dealing with the amoeba to man theory of evolution, macroevolution, as some call it. Almost invariably, when people talk about the theory of evolution, that's what they're talking about, this molecules to man idea, that the Earth's first living beings appeared in its warm waters more than a billion years ago and developed into the mighty throng of invertebrates, the boneless animals. And from them came the amphibians, and from them came the reptiles. And in turn, the reptiles gave form to warm-blooded birds and mammals, including man. And that's the theory of evolution in a nutshell. It states that all organisms have evolved from common ancestors in a gradual historical process of change and diversification. This theory rejects the notion that all organisms were designed and created at the beginning of time. Evolution is the only alternative you have when you reject the idea that organisms were created by God and designed for their various functions on Earth. The evolutionary concept tries to explain things without God, and some have attempted to force the Bible into harmony with this theory and have produced the mongrel philosophy, often called theistic evolution, which really isn't acceptable to either side. There are three great problems confronting an atheistic evolutionist. Number one, by what process did matter originally come into existence out of nothing? Number two, by what process did life come from non-life? And number three, by what process did consciousness come from non-consciousness? Nobody's ever been able to answer any one of those three questions without God. And when they try, the lack of logic is amazing. They'll make statements like, most biologists think it probable that life did arise from non-living matter by natural processes. And then sometimes a few pages later, or even on the same page, they'll say, scientific experiments demonstrated that spontaneous generation, the accidental springing into existence of life from non-living material, does not occur in any known cases. You know, there was a time when it was commonly believed that if you leave a bunch of dirty rags in the bottom of your closet, that mice will spontaneously generate out of those rags. Or if you leave a slab of meat laying out, that maggots will spontaneously come to life out of that meat. Or at the edge of the mud on your pond, turtles will spontaneously spring into life out of that mud. Now we know better than that. Now we know that it takes an egg from a mother turtle to make a new turtle. Now we know that if you leave a slab of meat laying out, but you put it under a jar where the flies can't get to it, it will not spontaneously generate maggots. This experiment was done a few hundred years ago, and that's how we discovered that maggots and flies were connected. We've learned now that spontaneous generation does not happen. And I don't know of anybody who believes in it, that spontaneous generation occurs in nature, except for the people who say that that's how life came to be on this earth. That's the strange thing about this whole thing. We now know that spontaneous generation does not occur in nature. So why do they continue to cling to a theory that's squarely opposed to decided scientific law? Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, that the God of this world hath blinded the eyes of the unbelieving. They're living in fantasy land. Let's look at some of the mechanisms that evolutionists say are responsible for the development of great classes of living things. Two basic arguments are used. And when these are shown to be untenable, the theory of evolution ought to be rejected by all reasonable people. I'll just put a couple of words up here. One of them is mutations, and the other natural selection. George Gaylord Simpson, who in his day was known as Mr. Evolution by many people, said, "All evolutionary change depends in the final analysis on mutations," end quote. Another man named Beck said, "Random genetic mutation is the only source of evolution." And regarding natural selection, Sir Julian Huxley said, a century after the publication of The Origin of the Species, "Darwin's great discovery of the universal principle of natural selection is firmly and finally established as the sole agency of major evolutionary change." Lots of scientists have said that evolutionary change depends on mutation and natural selection. And I want to show you that when these two arguments are weighed in the balance, they are found to be wanting. Let's talk about mutations for a moment. A mutation is a change in the genetic structure of an organism. Nobody knows exactly what causes these changes to occur in nature. We do know that they can be artificially induced by radiation, by chemicals, by other things that we can do. That changes occur within certain limits is undeniable. What I do deny is that mutations can precipitate sufficient change that's necessary for the formation of some new kind of animal or plant. And that's what evolution requires. Let me give you a few facts about mutations. Number one, they occur very rarely. C.H. Waddington said, "Mutations occur once in a million animals or once in a million lifetimes. The odds against a mutation occurring are very remote." Secondly, mutations are destructive. One of the nation's foremost geneticists, H.J. Mueller, said, "Most mutations are bad. In fact, good ones are so rare we may consider them all as bad." And third, mutations are unable to create anything. They only change existing structures. H. Graham Cannon said, "A fact has been obvious for many years, and that is that Mendelian mutations," and most of you know that Gregor Mendel was the monk who did so much work with genetics and gave us the foundation for all of our studies of genetics still in our own time, "is that Mendelian mutations deal only with changes in existing characteristics, never in the appearance of a new functioning character," end quote. Dr. Richard Goldschmidt of the University of California cataloged a number of structures which he claimed could not have possibly been developed by means of mutations, and he's talking about rather fundamental things like hair, feathers, blood circulation, nerves, compound eyes. You can go on with the list. Since mutations rarely occur and are destructive when they do, since they only change what's already there and can't create anything new, we can regard them as negative processes. So why do evolutionists depend on such negative processes for the forward, upward progress of the human race that's demanded by the theory of evolution? Rather than complementing the theory of evolution, the facts about mutations actually destroy the theory of evolution. Now, natural selection was called by Darwin the survival of the fittest. It suggests that a living creature can acquire certain characteristics when environment demands it. These acquired features can then be passed on to the offspring. Darwin taught the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Now, most modern evolutionists no longer believe that facet of evolution. They've modified Darwin's position. Some of them call it creative selection. There is some limited validity to the concept of natural selection. Everybody knows about the moths on the trees in England at the time of the Industrial Revolution. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the trunks of the trees were light-colored, and so the black moths were the ones that got eaten most by the birds because the birds could see the black moths better. But then when the Industrial Revolution blackened the trunks of the trees, then the light moths were the ones that were eaten most often, and the black ones were selected out to survive and go on and reproduce. Everybody knows about that that concept of adapting to an environment. But that's a long way from proving that there have been changes from one kind of an animal into another kind of an animal. Natural selection might eliminate unfavorable characteristics, but it can't create characteristics. This was succinctly put by evolutionist Hugo de Vry when he wrote, "Natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest." And that very succinctly encapsulates my point. Natural selection can never explain how you get from an amoeba to a man. It can't even explain how you get from a cold-blooded animal to a warm-blooded animal. Natural selection gets uncomfortably close to the view that an adequate number of monkeys tapping on typewriters for an adequate length of time will inevitably produce an encyclopedia. Isn't that wonderfully scientific? If they haven't produced an encyclopedia yet, you just haven't given them enough time. Time becomes the god here. Time is what produces the miracle eventually. Evolutionist Professor E.H. Waddington said concerning natural selection that it is the theory that if you start with any 14 lines of coherent English and change it one letter at a time, keeping only those things which still make sense, that you will eventually finish up with one of the sonnets of Shakespeare. He said, "It strikes me as lunatic logic, and I think we should be able to do better." Well, it is lunatic logic. But evolutionists are not able to do better because the theory is totally void of true scientific evidence. Dr. Richard Goldsmith tried unsuccessfully for 25 years to create new types of gypsy moths by natural selection. He eventually gave up because he could not get them to go beyond the normal characteristics of the species. It seems that any unbiased person ought to be able to see that the evidence for the mechanism of evolution is completely lacking, and the whole theory is an attempt to escape the obvious alternative, namely the creation of the world by God, to whom we are responsible for our conduct. Now, in high school or college, we are confronted with arguments designed to convince us of evolution, and I'd like to just deal with a few of these as time allows. One of these is usually called comparative anatomy. Comparative anatomy. If you take the wing of a bat and a cat's leg and paw and the flipper of a whale and the forefoot of a turtle, the forefoot of a frog, and a man's hand and arm, then you can see that there are undeniable similarities. There are undeniable similarities in the structural features of apes and humans. The bone material is the same, calcium phosphate. The upper and lower portions are proportionally alike. So evolution assumes that this proves that they are kin to each other or related to each other, that is, that one has descended from the other. When in reality, it proves nothing of the kind. It just shows that there was a designer who fashioned living organisms after a common plan. Yes, we all came from the same source. But the question is, what was that source? Was the source slime or sublime? If living creatures are to inhabit the same earth, if they are to use the same elements to function, then why wouldn't they be similar in design in many respects? Was God obligated to create each living thing completely different from everything else? Of course not. And if he had done that, we wouldn't have had many of the advantages that our physical similarities to the animal kingdom give to us. The reason that you and I can enjoy a steak or chicken or fish or ham is that our bodies are similar enough to those animals that we can digest these foods and be nourished by them. We can take the valve out of a pig's heart and use it in your heart so that you survive, only because your body is similar enough to the body of a pig. Insulin out of animals has been used many times to help people who can't produce it themselves, and we could go on and on with these kind of illustrations. We're talking here about comparative anatomy. Within the cells of living organisms, there are chromosomes containing genes. These genes are the vehicles of heredity. In humans, the cells contain 46 chromosomes. In chimpanzees, each cell contains 48 chromosomes. And one might assume then, based on comparative anatomy and comparative genetics, that there is a close kinship between man and chimp. Well, a potato also has 48 chromosomes in each cell. Just a common potato. So if this argument has any validity, you are as closely related to a French fry as you are to a chimpanzee. Who can really believe it? That's not even in harmony with what evolutionists believe. Dr. John Moore, a naturalist at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, said that on the basis of chromosome count, Darwin's theory of evolution flunks out. He said, if man evolved from a simple amoeba-like organism, there should be an increase in chromosomes and in the quality of genetic material carried by the chromosomes as the complexity of animals increases. To the contrary, he said, absolutely no pattern of increase of chromosome number from less complex to most complex is at all detectable. Chromosome count actually shows man ranking lower than frogs and toads. Darwin's theory of evolution is more illogical than biological. Another one of the popular arguments for the theory of evolution is paleontology. This is the study of fossils, which is easier to spell than paleontology. If evolution occurred, we should expect to find a substantially complete record of evolutionary development in the crust of the Earth in successive layers. There is no complete record of evolutionary development in the layers of the Earth. These layers, according to the theory, would naturally correspond with the alleged development of living things from the beginning to the present. But what we actually do find is very different from that. And this bothered Darwin in his own day. He wrote in The Origin, quote, geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, end quote. He said that maybe this is one of the most obvious and maybe it's the most serious objection that can be raised against the theory of evolution. And he hoped we'd find more later, but the facts have not changed since his time. So that George Gaylord Simpson, speaking in Chicago at the Darwin Centennial, said, quote, it is a feature of the known fossil record that most taxa appear abruptly. A taxon is a group of organisms seen by taxonomists to form a unit. Taxa is the plural of the word. Taxa are arranged in a hierarchy from a kingdom on down to subspecies. There are 7 basic levels of taxa: kingdom, phylum, class, order, genus, family, and species. They are not, as a rule, led up to by a sequence of almost imperceptibly changing forerunners, such as Darwin believed should be usual in evolution. A great many sequences of 2 or a few temporarily integrating species are known, but even at this level, most species appear without known immediate ancestors. So what he's saying is that the missing links are still missing. In fact, world-renowned anthropologist Dr. Louis Leakey was asked about the missing link. He said, there is no one link missing. There are hundreds of links missing. And that's true. A Harvard professor said, links are missing just where we most fervently desire them. And it's all too probable that many links will continue to be missing, he said. And how right he is. He says we fervently desire these. Well, that doesn't sound like a dispassionate scientist, does it? He's got a theory he wants to prove. The fervently desired links do not exist, and we can't find what was never there. That's what's going on. So-called prehistoric men are no proof at all of the theory of evolution. Several of these have been well publicized. Neanderthal man is widely appealed to as a sort of a subhuman from which man evolved. Evolutionist Ashley Montague said there is no reason to regard Neanderthal mental capacity as having been any different from that of modern man. Another evolutionist, William Strauss of Johns Hopkins University, said he refuted the notion that Neanderthal skeletons were evidence of stoop-shouldered, semi-erect ape men. Rather, he said, these skeletons had been twisted by advanced arthritis, but he said they were normal human beings. What these guys are saying is that Neanderthal man is just man. He's not some special kind of man. He's called Neanderthal because of where he was found in France, but he's just man. Fossil evidence reveals no such thing as semi-erect human beings. Cro-Magnon man was supposed to be a little more advanced than Neanderthal. He has a brain capacity that's just as large as of modern Europeans, and he was a magnificent artist. We know that because we found his work. There have been many hoaxes in an attempt to find missing links. Piltdown man is a famous example of this. Ashley Montague, an evolutionist, honestly states, quote, "The Piltdown skull is a fraudulent assembly of a human skull fragment together with the lower jaw of an orangutan perpetrated on the scientific world for 40 years. And that's true. We know now who did it and why he did it. He's trying to produce evidence of the missing link, and he got the scientific community all astir with this purposeful thing that he put together. Orangutan jaw and a human skull fragment. So how seriously should we take evolutionary scientists who can be fooled so drastically for 40 years? In 1959, Dr. Louis Leakey announced that he had discovered a missing link between man and his ancestors. He had pieced together 400 tiny pieces of skull fragments, which he named Zingianthropus. First, he claimed it was human. Later, he reversed himself and said it was non-human, but he dated it as being 1,250,000 years old. Maybe we should say just a word about the dating methods that are used, because that's part of this whole package. The dating methods are based on assumptions, whether you're talking about carbon-14 or the potassium-argon method or the uranium-to-lead method. They're all based on assumptions. Let me give you just one example mentioning uranium-to-lead. They're based on presuppositions that are evolutionary and uniformitarian in their thrust. The religion of the evolutionist, by the way, is uniformitarianism. By the time you get through writing that, you forget what you're writing. I hope that's spelled correctly. I wouldn't be able to see until I step to the back of the room. Uniformitarianism, that's the religion, that the present is the key to the past, that everything going on now has always been going on at the same standard detectable process rates. That's the assumption, and it's a religious assumption. It's taken on faith. And these dating methods are based on that kind of assumption, several assumptions, actually. Uranium to lead. Uranium breaks down into a series of elements that ultimately become lead. We know the approximate rate of that breakdown. So they'll take a rock and they'll measure the lead content of that rock, and they'll multiply the amount of lead in that rock times the known rate of decay, and then conclude that that's how old the rock is. This often troubles people who are uninitiated, but there are at least three things wrong with it, three assumptions. Number one, it assumes that all the lead in the rock all got there as a consequence of the decay process. Well, what if the rock was made with lead in it? That's going to throw your date completely off. It also assumes that the rate of decay from uranium to lead has always been the same rate as it is now. But what if there was a time in the past when the rate of decomposition was a lot faster? That would throw your dating way off. And probably nuclear decay rates were accelerated during the time of the flood and gradually slowed down to today's rates by about the time of Moses in 1500 BC. The third assumption is that all of the lead in the rock is there as a consequence of the decay process, and that no lead has come into the rock through some outside source along the way. Bottom line here is that they just cannot prove what they say, and unless you're willing to grant these assumptions, then the dating will not be valid. And by the way, these are highly questionable assumptions. But Dr. Richard Leakey, based on assumptions, dated Zingianthropus, this thing that he had found, as being 1,250,000 years old. Later on, his son, Dr. Richard Leakey, found bones which he claimed are 1,300,000 years older than Zingianthropus, and yet he classified them as modern man. The question is obvious. How can you have modern man allegedly 1,300,000 years older than one of man's prehistoric animal ancestors? There's just no basis for the doctrine of evolution from these mythical prehistoric men. And the pictures that our students see in textbooks are purely the products of imagination impregnated by the evolutionary concept. The evidence for evolution on the basis of fossils is extremely insufficient. Dr. Lewis T. Moore said, "The more one studies paleontology, the more certain one becomes that evolution is based on faith alone." And that's true. It's a religious faith. And the problem, of course, with that is that faith alone is just as insufficient in science as it is in religion. I'll give you another one of these. This is an interesting one. Comparative embryology, because this is one of the old standby arguments in the biology classroom, and it has been disproven, but is still taught and is still in some textbooks at this time. Once it gets in, it's hard to root it out. It is alleged, or has been alleged through the years by many evolutionists, that the embryo of a human being during the 9-month gestation period passes through all the evolutionary stages that the human race has passed through. The fancy way of saying this used to be is that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, because ontogeny is the development of the individual and phylogeny is the development of the human race. And the idea is that the embryo of a baby in the womb repeats the various stages through which the human race has passed during man's evolutionary past. George Gaylord Simpson, the paleontologist, said, quote, "It is now established that ontogeny does not repeat phylogeny. But the belief in this recapitulation theory became so widespread that it's still in some of the books about biology and evolution, including some of the textbooks, along with the little drawings made by a man by the name of Heichel to illustrate it. So we should be aware of what the recapitulation theory is supposed to be, and we should also be aware that it doesn't really happen." But it's an argument that has been one of the favorites of many biology teachers, because it's such a cool argument if it was just true, but it's not true. It's gone down the drain, and yet it's still taught sometimes. Evolutionists once thought that features which had been acquired could be inherited. Darwin said, for instance, that the monkey, by sitting on its tail, produced enough chafing or chapping that it eliminated the tail. And by that, this lack of a tail was inherited by baby monkeys, and now this is how we human beings, through evolution, lost our tail. Darwin wrote in the Descent of Man, quote, "As far as we can judge, the tail has disappeared in man owing to the terminal portion having been injured by friction during a long lapse of time," end quote. Now, most evolutionists don't subscribe to this, but I mention it for this reason. Herbert Spencer, a very prominent evolutionist, said, quote, "Either there has been inheritance of acquired characteristics, or there has been no evolution," end quote. We now know as a fact that acquired characteristics are not inherited. So if Spencer was right, there has been no evolution. There was a man by the name of Weissman who cut the tails off of 80 generations of mice, newborn mice, cut their tails off as soon as they were born, and every new mouse born in that chain still had a tail. At the 81st generation, they had tails just like the original generation. These types of experiments have been repeated many times. We used to do it with fruit flies when I took biology over at the University of Kansas back in another century. And we would go to the lab and check on our Drosophila, the fruit flies. You can produce a lot of generations real fast, and that's one reason those are commonly used. But so much of this stuff is just bogus. I'm sorry to have to be so blunt about it, but I feel like I need to be. Let's talk momentarily about vestigial organs. Vestigial organs, according to evolution, we have in our bodies certain features which are entirely useless. And the reason they're there is that they are simply remnants that are left over from the former phases of our animal ancestry. Things like the appendix, the thyroid gland, the pituitary gland. And you can go on and on with this. These have, at one time or another, received this classification. Due to our tremendous strides in medical knowledge, many of the so-called vestigial organs have been discovered to be of great value. A couple hundred years ago, I saw a list one time, I think there were 186 vestigial organs listed, parts of the human body that were considered to be vestigial. I think now we're down to about 4, if that many. Because God has equipped man to live anywhere on the earth, and every part of the human body is useful someplace on the earth. Vestigial organs are a terrible argument for evolution, and believing in the idea of vestigial organs has been bad for us too. When I was a little boy, way, way back, a long time ago, in the 1950s, it was very, very common. Somebody would go into the hospital, if they had to open them up down in this area, they would just snip off the appendix without giving it any thought. The old joke used to be that a doctor's wife found a book in her home, and the back part of the book had been ripped out. And she said to her husband, "What happened to this book?" And he said, "Oh, it was labeled appendix, and I just took it out without thinking." That's the way they used to do. Very commonly, this was done because the appendix is just a vestigial organ. It's just a leftover. You don't need it for anything. Later on, they found out that we do need the appendix. It's kind of like an oil can for the lower intestine. So as far as I know, they don't do that anymore. But it used to be just blithely done. People's tonsils removed very, very frequently back in those days, and not done nearly as frequently now, as far as I know. Later, we discovered that there were purposes to these things. The theory of evolution is unscientific, it's unscriptural, and it ought to be rejected by all honest people. Now, the Genesis account of creation, actually, I'm supposed to stop it. Should I go on or just stop? I don't know. Okay, good. There were some...
It's 10 after, but we had a song and a prayer.
Okay, so we go... Okay, well, let's go a little further. You just tell me, Alan, when to stop. The Genesis account of creation, it's one of the most criticized parts of Scripture, but it is a document that has stood the test of time. Genesis is a book of beginnings, and it starts by giving us the answer to one of the most fundamental questions that a person can ask. That is, where did everything come from? Just think if we didn't have the first two chapters of Genesis. The Bible would start with so many unanswered questions, it would seem like it was starting in the middle of things. We need those first two chapters, and we need to be able to rely upon them. It's been criticized as unscientific. It's been criticized as being too simple. It's been criticized as contradictory to what nature tells us. But it's actually what atheistic evolution tells us about origins that's contradictory to what nature tells us and to what God's Word tells us. Atheistic evolution tells us that everything came from nothing, that non-life evolved into life, which evolved into different kinds of life over millions of years. It tells us that complex functional design in nature did not have a designer, that intelligence comes from non-intelligence, that morality, if they believe in such, came from the amoral. But God, on the other hand, gives us the ultimate cause of everything. That law of causality, causation, the law of cause and effect, says that every material effect must have an adequate cause. What is the cause of the universe? If we believe in atheistic evolution, well, it's a big bang from a tiny ball of matter 14 billion years ago, causing not just our Milky Way galaxy, but all the other galaxies as well. Is that a great enough cause to produce such an effect as we see? Or is God the great cause? So much easier to just believe in God as the great cause who is infinite, who is uncaused, who is eternal, who is omnipotent, who is omniscient, who is non-physical. This great spirit, God, is the creator of the heavens and the earth. The Bible says in its very first sentence that there is a rational cause for the universe and of we ourselves. And the law of cause and effect is not the only law that agrees with what we see in nature and in the Bible. The first law of thermodynamics says that in nature, matter and energy are neither created nor destroyed. In nature, we see that things do not just pop into existence out of nothing. And this has perplexed even atheistic evolutionists. There was an article called "What Triggered the Big Bang?" This statement was made. "Indeed, the quest to understand the origin of the universe seems destined to continue until we can answer a deeper question. Why is there anything at all instead of nothing?" Same thing that John Paul Sartre, the atheist novelist, asked. "If my atheistic position is true," he said, "there shouldn't be anything here, but there is something here, including me, and I can't understand why that should be." It's the age-old question. If there is no God, then where did things come from? Because you can't get something in nature from nothing. So the first law of thermodynamics is recognized as valid and as true by scientists around the world, and it fits perfectly with the Word of God and with what we see in nature. Is that saying we're done? You were waving? Oh, you're waving at somebody else? Okay. All right. Well, I don't even see it. Alan just left, I guess. So. Are we supposed to stop her? Okay. Finally got an affirmative on that. We'll take it up there a little later, Lord willing.